This is the Technology Evangelist with Scott Schweitzer, and thank you for tuning in.
This episode is brought to you in part by Solarflare Communications. With over 1,500 customers worldwide, Solarflare has been providing the server NIC cards that have accelerated electronic trading for a decade. This fall, Solarflare is looking for companies willing to beta test their new firewall in a NIC technology called ServerLock. In return for testing, you will receive several dual-port 10 gigabit NICs. To sign up, please click on the link at the bottom of this podcast. Solarflare, where neural class networks are made simple. For more information, please visit www.solarflare.com.
This is the Technology Evangelist. Today we're with Bob Van Valza, and we're talking about blockchains and digital currencies. So Bob, why don't you catch us up real quick on blockchain technology? Give us a summary from where we were the last time, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay, sure, Scott. If you want to go back, you can get the details. I'll just real quickly say that distributed ledger technology, blockchain technology, writes down a list of transactions and does that in a robust way where there's many copies of the ledger. And because it's many copies of it, it's very hard to attack. And so far, it's been unhackable. Nobody who has tried has figured out how to take money out of it that isn't intended to be transferred. So it's a way to permanently write things down and have them available for everyone to see. And the work of writing down those transactions, we said, was done by guys who are called miners. And they have expensive equipment, and they get paid for the work of doing that. This is called signing the transactions, and that's extending the chain of blocks, which contain the transactions. So you end up with this many copies of a perfect record of where the money went and who it came from and who it went to in a way that it can't be lost. There'll always be a record of all the transactions on the blockchain.
So now to jump right into Bitcoin and digital currencies, we hear folks talking about fiat currencies. Can you give us some background on what a fiat currency is?
Sure. So fiat currencies are really the alternative for the average person to Bitcoin. And it's the money you use every day. So in some ways, explaining what fiat currencies are is like explaining what water is to a fish. It's important because so much of what we take for granted about the money we use every day is, well, exactly taken for granted. So the key question you have to ask about the dollar bill you hold in your hand is, where does the value come from? You don't think of that because you've either worked to earn the dollar bill or you got the dollar bill, you found it on the sidewalk. It's not worth a dollar because you can get a dollar's worth of heat when you burn it. And it's not worth a dollar because you can put the dollar bill into your gas tank and drive your car. You can use it to buy gasoline for the car. You can use it to buy natural gas to heat your home. But the paper itself is really worth nothing. And the ink and the printing and all that makes it worth a little more, but it's still just a nicely decorated piece of paper. It has value far more than its cost to the paper and the ink and the printing because our government says this is worth a dollar. And the other side of that is because when you hand that dollar bill to the guy at the gas station or the natural gas company, you know, when you buy energy with that dollar bill, that person can turn around and spend it to buy a gallon of milk or whatever is important to them, eggs, you know. So its value comes not from the properties of the paper or, you know, in the old days it did when we had gold coins and silver coins and things like that. But since we've gone off that, metals-based money systems, now we're on what are called representative money systems, and the value is coming from just the government saying by fiat, you know, we say this is worth a dollar, so it is. And the other thing the government gets to say about this kind of money is that it's a requirement that you pay your taxes using this kind of money. So you have to pay your taxes in dollars. You can't pay them in Bitcoin. And but by the same token, you can't pay your U.S. taxes in, you know, with Japanese yen. You have to use U.S. dollars to pay your U.S. taxes. So it's not very novel in that regard. So fiat money in general is just money where the value comes from the government saying that it has value, and therefore all the citizenry accepts the, you know, the representation, whether it's paper or coin or whatever, as having value because it does. You can use it every day.
So as long as people have faith in the government, the value of the money is derived from that faith and trust in the government. For context, how do these cryptocurrencies, you know, differ from previous money technologies?
Well, before we had money, we had barter. So I had chickens and you had goats. And, you know, as long as you were hungry for goats and I was hungry for chickens, you know, we could swap three chickens to a goat or whatever, you know, ratio we wanted. But the problem was, you know, if you get lots of goats at the same time I get lots of chickens, you know, you're not hungry and I'm not hungry and nobody buys or sells anything. So the advantage of the first use of money in many ways was what's called a store of value. which means, you know, at the time you have excess goats or, you know, chickens, you can say, well, I've got more chickens than I need. I'll take fewer chickens and more dollars, or, you know, puka shells or whatever the unit of money was. And I could do the same on my side. And then when I had, you know, when I was hungry and had dollars, I could turn the dollars back into food. So that's using money as a store of value. And that was one of the, you know, big innovations in human societies. And then from there, we progressed to what was called commodity money. This would be things like where there really is something like gold in the coin, and there's a dollar's worth of gold in the coin, or they had used to have what they called silver certificates. Well, I guess that's actually a gold certificate or a silver certificate is what's something else that's called representative money, because clearly the piece of paper isn't made out of silver.
Right.
So that's a gold certificate. And then in some ways that's often called commodity-backed money, because there's a commodity like gold or silver behind it. And then finally you get to the fiat money, which is what we were just talking about. And that really, it's the same as representative money. You just sort of take away the representation and say, as you said, it's the faith in the government that gives money the value, not the fact that you could turn it into gold, which you could use to make jewelry or something.
So what are the disadvantages of regular money, fiat money, in general, when compared to other things that are out there?
So, you know, I should say as a disclaimer that pretty much all, you know, disadvantages are relative, and they may not matter to you. To a lot of people, they look at what the government can do with fiat money, where the government can change the supply, and they say, well, that's manipulating the money supply. And I actually look at it and say, well, you know, if we have 10 countries on Earth and each country has their own money, there's going to be times in the politics of the whole country when I need to print more money to make my citizenry happy or to get reelected or to, you know, fund hurricane relief or whatever. So I'm going to print money, and that devalues my currency relative to your currency. So that's I don't see money decisions, what are called monetary policy decisions, as, you know, evil or maniacal governments out to hurt their people. But you certainly can point to cases in Zimbabwe, I think it was, where they got to the point where you literally needed a wheelbarrow to carry your, you know, money to the store to buy a gallon of milk, because they had inflated the value of a dollar so much that the dollars weighed, you know, it was giant chunks of, you know, stacks of paper that were required to buy even the ordinary things of life. So, you know, printing money can get out of hand. So that's the possibility of manipulation of the money supply, which happens with all regular money like we have today.
That's the government side of it. But what about the actual media itself, the failings and or issues with the currency itself?
The physical money like we have is difficult to secure. I mean, there's always stories of people who put, you know, money in a mattress to save it. They have to invent things like banks. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it is an enormous amount of money that goes into making more money, running the mint, you know, printing bills, they wear out, you know, and printing coins. It's expensive to produce money, currency and coins. And of course, anything that can be produced by the government can be produced by a counterfeiter. So you have the costs of counterfeiting. And finally, you know, actual money that you touch is dirty and germy because it's been, you know, touched and sneezed on by other people before it got to you. I mean, these aren't, you know, pressing problems, but you know, anytime you use a credit card to pay for something, you're avoiding all of these problems. Like, credit cards aren't as hard to secure, and, you know, they don't pay as much to produce them, and blah, 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 blah. This is one of the reasons that cashless transactions are as popular now as they are.
So then when we go to Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, because they're a virtual currency, they've got other advantages. So why don't we go over some of those in comparison to the fiat money or the regular money we're all used to using?
Sure. So because virtual currencies are ledger-based, nothing actually changes hands. It's just two parallel changes in the ledger. So the ledger says, I have less money, Scott has more money, instead of me physically handing Scott a dollar bill. It's purely virtual. There are physical bitcoins that have been made, but really those were made as a stunt, so that you could literally hand someone a bitcoin. The problem with that is that you have to print the private key on the bitcoin for it to have any value. And as soon as you print the private key on there, then it's sort of like a bearer bond. You know, it's
right.
Whoever's holding it has the ability to spend it, and that probably isn't what you want.
Or I could sit down and copy the private key off it with a pen and paper and go do it somewhere else without the actual coin nearby.
Right.
So it's almost worse than a bearer bond.
In many ways it is, because you can hand that to the next guy and say, here it is, it's a whole Bitcoin, go spend it. And when he tries to, he finds out you've already spent it because, you had the private key. So, there's all those problems that come in when you try and make something that's inherently virtual into a physical object. Another thing to think about is that, all of these blockchain currencies, cryptocurrencies, are independent of governments. So far, there is no government who's said, we're tired of spending all that money on the mint. we think it'd be better to invent the local Bitcoin currency for our citizenry. Hasn't happened yet. It certainly could happen someday. I don't think it's too likely. But the key point is that the cryptocurrencies can continue to exist without a government there to give them value. And because they aren't tied to one particular government, as, dollars and yen are tied, they're inherently international. So the Bitcoin in Japan is the same as the Bitcoin in the U.S. And in effect, a Bitcoin can be sent, if you will, from Japan to America, from a wallet in Japan to a wallet in America without paying any sort of taxation at the border. And that's a very important advantage to people who do a lot of international transactions. I can tell you, when our company had employees, even just in London, the amount of, money we had to send to London, to get money in their bank account was far higher than what the employees actually received by the time we got through all the foreign exchange rigmarole. It's very expensive to send money across government borders.
So it might have been better to just pay them in Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, it's happening at a lot of Bitcoin startups. They're just paid in Bitcoin. You in some ways that shifts the burden, because then the employee now has to figure out how to get it turned back into money they can spend at the local gas station or utility company, and then they probably pay tax on it then. But hopefully they still pay less tax than they would if they went through the normal mechanism where the money changers collect it. The last thing that I think is different in an important way about cryptocurrencies is that we mentioned manipulation before, or the changes in supply at the will of the government. With cryptocurrencies, at least in the Bitcoin case, the existence of Bitcoins and the production of new Bitcoins, the mining rate is all fixed. And we touched on that briefly before, but the net effect is that if you just know what year and day it is, you know how many Bitcoin there are on Earth. And that's true for the past, and that's true for the future. So we don't have an Alan Greenspan, or I guess it's Janet Yellen, we don't have government bureaucrats, sounds negative, but I mean, we don't have government agencies who look over the amount of Bitcoin and say, crank up the printing presses, we'll make more, or hold some back because it would be better for our foreign policy or our domestic policy. We just have more Bitcoins at a rate which is known for all. And that means that's both good and bad. It means that if there were a country using Bitcoin for their local supply and they desperately needed to have more money because of hurricane relief or whatever, there's no knob they can turn to make more Bitcoin in Puerto Rico. But it also means that, an evil government can't inflate away the value of your cash that you're holding. So it's just a property of these things.
So you mentioned before about the predictable generation rate. We talked about this in a previous podcast. It was basically 10 minutes between the generations of Bitcoin. You mentioned at one point that there's actually a correction that occurs every 4 years.
Yeah, that's really the only part we didn't go into in any depth. But what it boils down to is the actual number of Bitcoins produced would grow forever if there'd be no end to the production. And the designers of Bitcoin wanted it to behave a bit more like a commodity, like gold. Not a commodity like chickens, where you can always grow more chickens. But if you think about the Earth's crust, there's only so much gold in the Earth's crust, and people have had very strong incentives to search the Earth's crust to find any gold that was just laying around and they could pick it up and walk away. And then they had incentives to dig deeper and look for gold, and deeper and deeper mines, more and more technology for extracting the gold. And at some point, though, the production rate of gold will decline, and the designers of Bitcoin wanted to have that same sort of decline. So every 4 years, the rate of producing Bitcoins falls in half. So it started out that every 10 minutes, they made 50 bitcoins, and that was good for the first 4 years. And then every 10 minutes, they make 25 bitcoins. And now we're down to 12 and a half bitcoins every or I guess it'll soon shift over. I've forgotten when the shift is or was. But because it's halving, it's sort of an asymptotic curve. And I think in 2140, the last one will be mined. There's 21 million of them.
Okay.
About 16 million today.
So we've got about 16 million today. And you said there'll be about 21 million total.
Yep.
And then each one of those bitcoins obviously can be fractioned up. Because, you know, you're not going to necessarily spend a whole Bitcoin to buy, you know, a loaf of bread.
Well, hopefully, you know, when they were worth less than a dollar, there was a guy who bought two pepperoni pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoins in the very early days, you know, when they were essentially worthless. So it has changed. But no, you're right, Scott. That's a key point that each Bitcoin is divisible, and it's divisible into 100 million pieces. Each of those pieces is called a Satoshi. And I did a little bit of math and figured out that the gross world product is about $100 trillion. And so it basically works out that you could represent the gross product of the world in pennies with Bitcoins. So okay. We don't have to worry that they're not divisible enough. We'll always be able to subdivide a Bitcoin to make the equivalent of a penny. Unless we want to start paying micro pennies, then we have to worry about micro Satoshis or something. $10 still gets in just fine.
This has been the Technology Evangelist with Scott Schweitzer and Bob Van Valza talking about digital currencies. Thank you all for your time and have a good week.